Adelson.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Amy Adelson, and I represent the defendant in this case, John Tuma, and sitting at counsel table is James Boren, who's my co-counsel on appeal and tried the case. The prosecutor began her summation with these words: "This case boils down to the credibility of witnesses. It's about whether, at the end of the day, you believe the defendant or you believe Wayne Mallett, Todd Cage, and Cody Tuma." And for once, the prosecution and the defense agree. This case was about the credibility of witnesses. But the jury couldn't fairly weigh the credibility of witnesses in this case because John Tuma was unfairly precluded from presenting the most important evidence in the case that would have demonstrated to the jury that the government's witnesses were not telling the truth. Mallett, Cage, and Cody told a story without any details, muddled and inconsistent, about a plant that was a total sham, a pretense plant. None of the equipment worked, and most importantly, they testified it was dumping 1 million gallons of untreated wastewater into the Red River on a daily basis. Before trial, the court ruled that two areas of testimony were off limits to the defense. One was evidence about the lack of environmental harm, and the second was evidence about the operation and efficiency of the plant.
Now, the evidence about lack of environmental harm, is that the aspect of your argument where you're saying the jury didn't get to assess the credibility on that point? No?
Yes, exactly, Your Honor, because what the impact of this ruling meant that Mr. Tuma could not show the jury that it was virtually inconceivable that the ARCLA plant was dumping 1 million gallons of dirty water into the Red River on a daily basis for the period of the indictment, which is over a year, and no one noticed it.
But from what I read, lack of environmental harm wasn't an element of the offense, but more to the point, at least as much as I read, notwithstanding the trial judge ruling, it looks like that got in. I mean, either through the witness or certainly at least part of the closing argument I looked at, it looks like, I mean, that thrust of that, the jury was aware of. So assuming first off, you know, you say that's error, I mean, just help me understand how
okay.
The jury never ultimately heard. All right.
There were two preclusion rulings, and I want to distinguish between them because when it came to lack of environmental harm, that was absolute, excuse me, Your Honor, that was an absolute preclusion. Mr. Boren raised it again at the beginning of the trial, and the court stuck to his ruling, I'm not going to hear anything about environmental harm or the lack thereof. The court made a mistake, I think an honest mistake, but a fatal one. The court thought that because environmental harm is not an element of the government's offense, and it's not the lack of environmental harm, is not an affirmative defense, it wasn't relevant. But of course, to the defendant, it was extremely relevant because the defense was what the government's witnesses were claiming happened did not happen. And showing that it did not happen was the key to his defense.
So you're arguing it would have gone to causation? Are you arguing it would have gone to causation if he could have established that there was no environmental harm? Then it couldn't have been caused by this dumping. But isn't the dumping the problem with or without the permit?
No, because he was arguing there wasn't dumping. Not that if there was dumping, it didn't cause environmental harm. He was arguing there was no environmental harm because there was no dumping. If I could give an example, let's say a defendant is charged with leaving the scene of an accident, and he doesn't have a scratch on his car. Well, it doesn't matter whether he has a scratch on his car to the crime of whether you've left the scene of an accident. But if the defendant gets on the stand and says, you got the wrong guy, I wasn't there, I didn't do this thing.
Was he arguing actual innocence? Was defense counsel?
Yes. He was arguing. Ms. Griffith, the prosecutor, asked him at the very beginning of his argument, Mr. Tuma, let's get this straight. Are you saying you didn't know about it? Or are you saying it didn't happen? And he said, this didn't happen. It was physically impossible to happen, and that's the second area of preclusion where there was some leeway given in response to your question, Chief Judge Stewart, and that it was inconceivable that it happened without anyone noticing it. He wanted to put in evidence to show that LDEQ, the state agency that monitored the river, that had monitoring equipment down at the river, for this long period of this excessive volume of dumping, never once cited ARCLA for contamination, never once came to ARCLA and said, yes, funny things are happening at this river. He wanted to put in evidence to say no casual observer, or certainly no experienced observer like Charles Tubb, saw any dead vegetation or dead fishes at the river. And imagine to the jury, they're hearing someone say a million gallons are being dumped on a daily basis. And the government has sort of taken the position, well, that was an exaggeration. But it's a dramatic exaggeration. Something like 15 times these witnesses testified to a million gallons of dumping in the river. These jurors had to be envisioning a fairly polluted river, and that wasn't true.
To be clear, though, you're saying the defense was no dumping, period. Irrespective of how much, but the defense was that there was no unlawful dumping by him.
Not the way the government witnesses testified. Mr. Tuma was not there every day. At some point, very shortly into the indictment period, the plant was purchased by CCS, which is a large Canadian company that engaged in thorough due diligence. And Mr. Tuma, though he remained in charge to some extent, was not there every day. So certainly he can't testify. He can't claim I know everything that's happening on the days I'm not there. But to the story being told by the government's witnesses, that story, he's saying, that story couldn't have happened. That story was physically impossible.
So you want the jury to believe if the story of millions of gallons is incredible, ergo, they have no credibility, ergo, nix the indictment.
Pretty much exactly. I think he wanted to say, if Mr. Cage, I'd like to get to the second area, which is the operation and efficiency of the plant, because they're tied in together. The judge did give Mr. Tuma some leeway at trial. He gave Mr. Boren the chance to take Mr. Tuma through some diagrams and show what equipment was on the plant and how what it was supposed to do and how the pipes worked. But what Mr. Tuma couldn't do was bring someone in to testify that it was physically impossible to dump a million gallons of water, dirty water, from that plant in a 24-hour period. There was one river, there was one pipe, discharge pipe to the river, a 6-inch pipe. Water flowed through that pipe at a rate of 600 gallons per minute. An expert, a technical expert, could have come in and said, you simply can't dump a million gallons of water through that pipe in a 24-hour period. And we're not even talking about a 24-hour period, because we have to subtract from that 24-hour period, because according to the government's witnesses, for a goodly period of time, the plant was discharging so-called phony clean water from tank B1, and it took 6 to 9 hours to discharge the water from that tank. So that leaves us with maybe 16 hours to do this evil dumping. But we're not even talking about 16 hours because Todd Cage testified we only dumped at night. So now we're talking about 10 to 12 hours, which is about 300,000.
Was there any evidence that the water that was apparently alleged by the government to be dumped, the dirty water, the polluted water. Was there any evidence by your client that that water had actually been cleaned and was stored somewhere else and was contained?
That was precisely the evidence he wasn't allowed to put in. He was allowed. The court viewed this, in the court's view, what does it matter if the plant works if you were discharging, which is sort of a backwards way of looking at it, because again, the defense was it matters entirely how the plant worked if the plant, because we say it wasn't discharging, and he was precluded from showing in any kind of detail how the plant worked and how it was discharging the clean water. He had to rush through those 15 minutes and talk about various machines.
Discussion lasted close to an hour.
The actual diagrams that he was went through was 15 minutes. Throughout the case, because it was impossible to try this case by either side without talking about the equipment on the plant, there was evidence about the equipment on the plant. But Mr. Boren could not go in there and try this case knowing that he was going to present technical details to show that the government's story wasn't true. The government's witnesses talked in generalities, absolute generalities. They said there was a spaghetti bowl of pipes and there was pumps and hoses jumping around. I think that's an actual phrase, jumping around. And they talked about bypasses and horseshoe valves, but they never said how this happened. And if Mr. Tuma had been allowed to come in and say, this couldn't happen, this just couldn't happen, I think the jury verdict would have been very, very different. I want to give one more example. Integral to the government's case was this theory of the scam. And the scam was the ARCLA employees in on this scam would stand by the road and look for the city inspector's trucks. And when they saw them, they would call up to the plant. And then what would happen? According to Mallett and the others, they would turn off a pump and close a valve that was pumping 600 gallons of water per minute through a 6-inch pipe. Somehow, they would then take that water that's just stopped at the end of the pipe, push it back, discharge, disengage that pipe, re-engage that pipe to tank B1 where the clean water was, start the pump up again, get the water discharging, and get it to the composite sample all before the inspectors reach the inspection site. Well, imagine if a technical expert had gotten on the stand and said to the jury, what would really happen if you turned off a pump on this highly pressurized water? This isn't turning off your kitchen sink, and this isn't turning off your kitchen sink and attaching it to your bathroom sink. This is not stopping a scooter, it's stopping a freight train. There is going to be impact if you turn off a valve that's got this much water rushing through a 6-inch pipe. The jury doesn't know that. This is sophisticated stuff and technical stuff, and there was no way the jury could understand that this was physically impossible.
What was the, I don't see an objection to it, what was the jury charged to find?
The jury had to find whether or not there was a discharge in violation of the permit with respect to the city, and that was a five, six-month period of time in 2006, and whether there was discharges to the river during two separate periods of time, the initial period of time when they were discharging to the city and a separate period of time at the end when they got the permit to the discharge to the city again. Significantly, although these guys testified that this plant didn't work, we couldn't treat a piece of water, there's a 6-month period in there from January to June when they were discharging legally to the Red River, and the government never claimed that they were discharging in violation of that permit. If they couldn't treat the water, wasn't that equally a crime? Well, maybe it's because the government couldn't get the LDEQ witnesses in to testify that there was illegal discharges into the river at that point. We'll never know because all of this was off limits. I have a very little bit of time left, and I just want to get into the sentencing because it's integrally related to this whole issue. Whether or not this evidence was relevant at the trial, it was pivotal at sentencing. Mr. Tumu was socked with a 6-level enhancement for continuous repetitive discharge to the river and a 4-level enhancement for violating a permit. The thing about these, and we don't contest the enhancements, despite what the government says in this group, the enhancements were appropriate. But this is an unusual guideline because it has a directed departure within it. The Sentencing Commission, recognizing that these significant enhancements encompass a wide range of conduct, directs the court to consider various factors, all of which go really to the severity of an environmental offense. And the very first factor it directs the court to consider is whether there was environmental harm. Having been precluded from putting in evidence of lack of environmental harm, harm at trial, Mr. Tuma was desperate for an evidentiary hearing where he could finally show the court, I'm not as culpable as other environmental violators because my conduct didn't cause environmental harm and you should damnably depart. And the court at sentencing said to the government, you never produced any evidence of environmental harm, none. And yet it still wouldn't let Mr. Tuma have a hearing where he would show not only that the government didn't produce evidence of environmental harm, but that there was no environmental harm. And he did so based on two, he denied the departure based on two factors. And one factor was the quantity of the discharge. And on that, he relied on the million gallons a day, which was the very evidence Mr. Tuma was not allowed to discredit during the trial.
All right.
So I see my time is up.
All right.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I've reserved five minutes for rebuttal,
and you can finish the point if you'd like. Ms. Cassier for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josette Cassier for the government. I would like to address the guideline issue just very briefly. The guideline gives a heartland area for the enhancement, and under the case law in the Fifth Circuit, that enhancement was appropriate for defendant for the both enhancements, and they were the I've forgotten the exact number of them, but it was number B1A and then B4. Those two enhancements were appropriate. And they do allow for a departure of upward or downward two levels upon certain findings. But they do not mandate the departure. It is a discretionary thing with the judge. He may depart if making certain findings. But it's a heartland, and the court is used to dealing with heartland-type guidelines. And the court found this is appropriate. I don't see a departure for either one of these, either direction. And the court relied on the one witness. There was only one witness that ever said anything about a million gallons, and that was Cage. And you can read the entire transcript as I have, and I could not find any other testimony regarding that.
What was the other estimate given?
Pardon?
What did the other witnesses
The other about? Witnesses really didn't estimate. They just talked about, you know, we did this every night. We discharged every night. We discharged every day. And there is testimony that there was not discharge only at night. Cage was the night supervisor. He worked at night. So he knew what was happening at night. Mallett and Cody, well, Cody worked both nights and days. But Mallett worked only days. He did not work night. And he testified there was discharge during the day. So these three witnesses testified there was discharge night and day, 24/7.
Cage cross-examined on the million-dollar estimate.
What he said, and if you will read his testimony, it's very brief. He said that at the peak of the when they were taking in water, they were taking in wastewater approximately 100. The most that they ever took in was 165 trucks, each containing approximately 5,000 gallons of wastewater. And then somehow he came up with a million. He was asked by the government attorney, well, that doesn't total a million gallons. Then he said, well, the other tanks had wastewater in them, meaning the four port tanks is what apparently he was meaning, and then other tanks on site had wastewater also, so all in all, it was a million. So it was not, he didn't clearly say that they were discharging a million gallons every day for any particular period. He did say at the peak, it would have been about a million gallons. Now the peak was sometime in late 2006.
Peak doesn't mean a day.
Pardon?
Peak didn't mean a day.
Right, it didn't mean one day, but it didn't mean 16 months, which is the period of time that the charges were. And just for the fun of it, I did some math, because supposedly they were not allowed to discharge more than 600 gallons per minute. And if you take a million, and at the rate of 600 gallons per minute, it takes 28 hours to discharge that. But they were discharging to the river and the city at the peak. The end of 2006 is approximately when the peak was. They were discharging both to the river and the city. So if you divide that up between the city and the river, that's roughly 14 hours. They could have discharged that amount, a million gallons. I'm not saying they did, and I don't think the testimony is clear that they did every day for any particular period of time, but it is possible.
I'm assuming that when Mr. Cage was on the stand and came with the $1 million, Mr. Boren's eyes lit up, and on cross-examine, he pressed him considerably on that matter. So give me a sense of the cross-examination.
Mr. Boren did ask him repeatedly about if you were doing a million gallons, blah, blah, blah. And the focus, I think, in the witness's mind was the last half of the question and not necessarily the million gallons. And Mr. Boren also asked of many witnesses that same question. And the proffer that was given for Charles Tubbs was that Charles Tubbs would testify that if a million gallons a day, every day, so that's assuming the entire 16 months that the indictment covered, were discharged, that the river, there would be some indication of it. But there was no testimony that this occurred every day for 16 months.
All right, an indication of what? I'm sorry.
The million gallon discharge.
The volume.
The volume, that's correct. That's correct. Now,
maybe you should get to, are you finished?
Well, let me just, yeah, on that, did the, given all that, I mean, how was the jury charge framed for the jury in terms of indictment? In other words, is there any quantity element of the charge that the jury has to find? Just,
no.
We understand the argument about the million gallons, but help me understand how the issue.
I don't believe the jury was charged that any particular amount went, and I truly do not recall the jury charge. I would have to look at it again.
Well, we don't have an objection, you know, in here on the field about the jury charge, but we all know that's the guidepost for what the jury ultimately has
to
find.
I'll tell you what the district judge said about it. He said it doesn't make any difference whether the plant worked or didn't work or how much. He said the law, what this case is about is, did they discharge to the city illegally? Did they discharge to the river illegally? And that's essentially it. And then, of course, the obstruction during Aubuchon's visit, the EPA investigator. And I want to get to the credibility issue. It's not just credibility about Cody, Cage, and Mallett. Defendant challenged them. They were inside the plant. They were his key people. There was nobody higher than them except defendant at the plant. Now, Troy Yonkers came in from CCS once the plant was sold, but he was only there a couple months, and he was there late, March 2007, to maybe April or May. Defendant was there the entire time, so were Cage, Cody, and Mallett. Those were his key people. But there was testimony from two city inspectors, Mercy Roan, I believe was her name, and then Chris Warren. These people actually went to the city discharge. They pulled samples during an illegal discharge. In fact, one of the times was when ARCLA was not supposed to be discharging. They pulled samples, and there was a chart in evidence with the analysis of that of those samples. And they were essentially untreated E&P wastewater, or very lightly treated, if at all. And the treatment that Cage, Cody, and Mallett testified about was that solids were depleted from the, or settled out from the wastewater, and oil was skimmed off the top. That was the extent of the treatment. The other machinery at the plant essentially did not work, or it ran, but it never got the materials down to the levels they should have been. And defendant's own expert, Tubbs, well, he wasn't really an expert, but he was an employee. Tubbs testified that he, at the end of 2007, the end of the summer, tried to get the reverse osmosis equipment running and tried to get the electrocoagulation machines working, and they never got them online, never got them to do what they were supposed to do. That was defendant's witness who testified to that. Cody, Cage, and Mallett all testified that the machines didn't work. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. And the proof is in what the city pulled from their discharge valves that was coming out of ARCLA, and that was water that was high in E&P waste, is what the city got. Also, when Aubuchon was there, he was the EPA investigator. He spent 14 days at the plant in 2007, I believe three or four in April, and then about 10 days in June. He never witnessed a legal discharge. He never witnessed a clean water discharge by the plant. And that's the obstruction charge, because that was when they caused the pumps to cavitate, and Cody and Mallett testified to their involvement in that. Cody claimed that the tanks at the port had been inadvertently contaminated, and a valve had been left open, and there is testimony to that effect. Cody and Mallett testified about that. One of them even wrote a description of it. I think it was Cody for Aubuchon. Aubuchon testified about it, and he was never able to witness a truly legal discharge. So that plant was not functioning in I think it was April when he was there. It was not functioning adequately to make a legal discharge, and for approximately 10 days when he was there in June, it did not function. So defendant did get to testify about the functioning of the plant. He did get to testify, and his witness testified about how parts of the plant functioned. He had 15 minutes with diagrams, and then roughly, Judge Stagg said, 32 minutes beyond that, in which he discussed further piping and different things of that nature, and then the Tubbs testimony. Let's see if there were anything else I want to cover. Defendant's claims that his defense was limited by not being able to testify about harm or prove harm. The judge expressly said that harm is not, and the statute provides, harm is not an element of the offense. Harm is not, and lack of harm is not an affirmative defense, and the cases say that. It's just not an element that needs to be proven. It is irrelevant, and the judge so held.
So that's not an issue of causation.
It is not. But it is simply, and the judge said this, he said, wastewater put in the river without a permit, did water with stuff in it that shouldn't have been in it go to the sewer plant? That's what this case is about, and not how good the plant is, and essentially not whether there was harm or not. It's just whether that water that shouldn't have gone there went there.
But it's not unusual in, you know, a jury case that the defense is not necessarily aimed directly at an element of the offense, but
right. And
in a word, to give the jury something else to think about in terms of if they're going to acquit him, and in this case it's rare because the defendant took the stand. From as much as I read of it, Judge Stagg's ruling was what you just said, but I thought somewhere else he either gave him some leeway to get this in somehow. Am I correct or what?
Yes. There were four diagrams that defendant was able to testify about how the plant was supposed to work. And he put that testimony on. The judge said should be able to cover that in 15 minutes, and Mr. Boren said that will be more than adequate, Your Honor, and went forward with it at that point. But he continued on for 32 minutes, the judge noted, after his 15 minutes, though not necessarily using those diagrams, but he did continue to testify. And then he got it through his own witness, Mr. Tubbs, about how certain pieces of equipment were to operate.
So the government didn't object when defense counsel elicited it from his witnesses. In other words, when he's trying to elicit it, you know.
Your Honor,
disregard
the government let right. A lot of things in. The government did not object to a lot.
That I got in reading this, there was a formal ruling excluding it, but it seemed notwithstanding. The point was there. So
the reason the judge let it in was because defendant did raise the credibility issue, and the government had put on testimony from those three witnesses who were inside ARCLA, who were the key people in ARCLA, that they testified the plant never worked. It was a sham plant. We put on a dog and pony show to sell the plant to CCS. They had that kind of testimony. So the judge said, in fairness, I'm going to let you say how the plant should have worked because they have raised this. So I'll let you put that in. And so he did. He put it in. And those exhibits are in there in the record.
What was the closing argument of defense? Did it contain or embrace this environmental harm issue? I mean, did he argue that to the jury to any degree or just to the credibility point?
They used credibility as their major argument, as I recall.
All right.
And relied heavily on the fact that these three guys, well, at least two of them, the night shift guys, testified that they had used marijuana and they drank on the job. It would be hard to imagine if they are unloading the number of trucks that they claim to have been unloading, that they had much time to do that. But they did claim that they did that. And defendant said that, oh, that affected everything, was that, you know, these were nothing but kids doing drugs and young men drinking on the job. But I think the government laid that to rest to some extent because there was so much going on that these people had to do.
What was the hearing that defense wanted on the sentencing?
On the sentencing hearing? They requested a hearing in their lengthy sentencing memoranda, and I don't know if you read the sentencing memoranda or not yet or have reference to it, but the judge stated, I have read several pounds of paper. The sentencing memoranda were extensive, both sides, but a lot from the defense. And they included, if I recall correctly, a lot of charts and diagrams and things of that nature with regard to the harm and the amounts of discharge and because of the enhancements that were there. And they did request a hearing. The judge did say, and I think I had quoted what he said, something to the effect of, do you want a hearing? Is there anything more that you have to add to what I have read, to all this, the sentencing memoranda? And defense counsel said, no, Your Honor, we have said everything we have to say in our papers. And so then the judge said, then we're to the point of ruling. Yes, Your Honor, and agreed. There was no objection to the fact that the judge did not have a hearing. There was no statement, we have all these witnesses here to testify at a hearing. There was nothing like that. They seemed to agree with the judge. In the reply brief, defense counsel states that there was an in-chambers meeting with the judge. But this judge allows people to object on the record when they come back into the courtroom. And I can't believe that there was no objection if there was intended to be an objection. And there is agreement if you read the first two pages of the sentencing memorandum, the sentencing hearing, you will see that there seems to be total agreement. Let's go forward. We've said everything. I would just like to say that the law is clear in each issue that defendant presented for review. And the real issue is whether the particular facts of this case require actions different from those that were taken or rulings different from those that the district judge made. The record demonstrates that Judge Stagg's rulings were consistent with the applicable law on each issue, and his rulings should be upheld on appeal. Defendant received a fair trial, and his conviction should be affirmed. Any further questions, Your Honors?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Saddleson, you have rebuttal.
There are a couple of points I want to make relatively quickly. I want to answer again Your Honor's question about didn't this evidence come in, because I really think it's important to distinguish between the evidence about how the plant operated and the evidence of lack of environmental harm. That didn't come in. It never came in any fashion, in any form. It was an absolute preclusion. Mr. Boren raised it again during trial. We cite to it in our brief, and the court said it doesn't matter, and the premise of the court's ruling is if there was dumping, it doesn't matter if the river is harmed. Well, what's wrong with that? It assumes dumping. Why have a trial? When the defense is there wasn't dumping, and the proof that there wasn't dumping is that there was no environmental harm.
But you
environmental harm, or the lack thereof, becomes relevant to a defense proposition of consequence to the
but
case.
But you acknowledge that environmental harm is not an element of the indicted offense, do you not?
Yes, but I don't think that's the standard alone for
well,
what's relevant.
I didn't say that you did. I'm just trying
to... No, we acknowledge that. We acknowledge and that, you know, lack of environmental harm is not an affirmative defense. If we're dumping, the fact that we didn't hurt the river is not relevant to our the crime of dumping. But if our claim is we're not dumping, then the lack of environmental harm buttresses, it corroborates our claim.
It's not an element of the offense. It's not an affirmative defense. So what's the probative worth, assuming relevance, got to be probative. So what's the probative worth of the evidence?
It's probative of the fact that the government's witnesses were not telling the truth. They were just not telling
the
truth.
How does environmental harm or not
because
go to... Hold it. Let me finish my question. But how does environmental harm or not traverse the issue of whether there is dumping or not in a credibility calculus?
Because despite the government's love-hate relationship with this million gallons of water a night, and by the way, it wasn't just Cage, and it was probably 15 or 20 times in the transcript, they testified, they told this jury a million gallons were going into the Red River over a lengthy period of time, maybe not every night, but for weeks, months, who knows?
All right, besides Cage, what other witnesses do you say testified?
Mallett testified to it. We have references in our brief, and I asked the court,
I can't show you now,
but we've referred into the record where Mallett confirmed the million-gallon figure. And by the way, the government, when you know, if they don't think the million-dollar figure was correct, they never asked Cage to correct his testimony. So if you're dumping a million gallons of dirty water into the Red River, somebody's going to see it. And that's what was relevant.
But you don't,
putting in a wetness.
You don't take the view that Mr. Bourne was disallowed from vigorously cross-examining Cage about this million-dollar figure. Now, when we read this transcript, that we're going to find that he was pressed to the mat on the believability, whatever, of that matter. You don't make that claim.
I do make that claim,
you
Your
do?
Honor. I do because he wasn't allowed to get into environmental harm, he couldn't ask Cage, well, did the LDEQ ever cite the plan for environmental contamination during this period? He couldn't ask Cage, how did you get a million gallons out of this plant? But they weren't even taking in a million gallons of water. How did you get a million gallons out of this plant during this time period? Because he was very restricted in what he could ask about the operation and efficiency of the plant. And, you know, a trial, defense counsel has to worry about a lot of things in a trial. He has to worry about whether he's going to annoy the judge by asking questions that the judge has said is off limits. He has to worry about how it appears to the jury if he's disregarding the judge. And he asked questions. He did a great job, if you ask me, at trying to get around this, but there were certain things that remained off limits. And I just want to quickly get to the whole manhole issue, because that's their one corroboration of this story, except that's sort of a red herring for two reasons. One, again, the defense was not allowed to explain what that manhole was. That was a complicated, complicated issue. What those city witnesses did is they went into a manhole that was filled with water that came from pipes all over, not just from Arkla, from plants that were flowing downstream into the manhole, from the sewage pipe. They were not sampling from the discharge line. They were sampling from the merged water from all of these different plants. And after this sampling, which supposedly showed that Arkla was committing these violations, their permit wasn't lifted. They weren't cited and lost their permit because there was tremendous protocol violations in the sampling. And in fact, the sampling really didn't prove what the government says it proved. In order to prove that, you would have to take from the discharge pipe itself, and that's not what they did.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity to argue this case.
All right, we thank both sides for the argument. We'll read the record and decide it. Ms. Cassier, it comes to the court's attention that this calendar year you are retiring from government services, and I would say on behalf of all my colleagues, we appreciate your years of coming to the John Minor Wisdom Courthouse and arguing cases on appeal to us, having done so very professionally and ably, and we salute you and wish you well in whatever transpires after government service.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. All right, with that, we call the